Thank you, William, and thank you, everyone, for coming out again this evening. It's good to see so many of you, and it really has been lovely meeting with you these Wednesday evenings and meeting many of you afterwards as well. If you have a Bible and you want to read with me, we're going to read a short passage from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And let's read together from verse 13. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as others who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so through Jesus God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep. For this we declare to you by a word from the Lord, that we who are alive and who are left until the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the voice of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will always be with the Lord. Therefore, encourage one another with these words. Well, grief is an experience that comes to everyone's door at some point. But why does grief happen? Why do we feel the way we feel? How do we explain the experience of grief? And can anything be done to help us through that period? And does grief have anything to say about me and my life? Some, in trying to describe what grief is, have found it helpful to look at life like a journey. So you have your life heading in a certain direction with certain goals ahead of you, a certain destination along a pathway that is familiar and comfortable. And thinking of life in that way, it gives us a certain purpose, a certain hope. We know what we're here for. We know the track we're on. We know where we're heading. And if you think about it, perhaps you can identify with that in, for example, your work life, where you have your pathway maybe mapped out and certain goals in front of you. Also, maybe your family life, as you think through the certain stages that your family will go through in the future. And maybe we don't always take time to stop and think about it, but we all have this certain pathway and goal to life. But every so often, we come up against things that block that pathway. Events and situations that require a change in direction, and then our goals change, and the aims that we once had are no longer attainable. We have to change our destination. We have to plot a new course. Life changes direction. And we call our response to that kind of change in life grief. Or a technical term that we sometimes use these days clinically is that we call it an adjustment reaction. It's a reaction within us to that adjustment or to that change in life. And it's a change that can be painful. And it can give rise to all sorts of emotional reactions, and that's what we call grief. Now, why is it that we react in such a difficult way? Why do we find that kind of change difficult? Well, whenever you think about it, the pathway that your life is on can become very comfortable and familiar to you. You get into a routine of work, a routine of family life, And moving outside of that pathway is kind of moving outside of your comfort zone, and it becomes almost like a threat, almost as we discussed last week when we were talking about stress. Think of a marriage, and think of then how within a marriage, if one of those marriage partners dies and the other is bereaved and left behind, and this couple who did everything together, and now one of those partners is left facing all of the situations of life alone, you can see how everything changes and life's direction changes for them. And what was a comfortable, familiar path can suddenly seem very different and threatening. Another reason why we find that kind of life change difficult is that it can sometimes mean giving up the goals that we've cherished. There are things we've been aiming for, and we have hopes, perhaps in relation to work, in relation to family life, in relation to other relationships, and we want to see those things achieved. We want to get that happy marriage. We want to have that comfortable income. We want to look forward to our retirement. And then some life event comes in, some change threatens those goals. Death, for example, meaning that those retirement years that we had looked forward to may be spent alone. We have to give up on the goals that we cherish. Another reason why we find change difficult is that actually we are creatures of habit. Again, it's part of how God has made us. It's a theme we've been touching on a few times over the last few weeks, about how God has made us. We are used to habit. Life gets into a pattern and into a routine of activities. And those patterns then can be hard to change because we get used to them. And the changes involve maybe picking up new things, new skills, new directions. For example, the husband who depended so much on his wife for everything at home, and she dies and he's left alone, and suddenly he's at sea because he's been so used to going his own way. We are creatures of habit. So those are a few reasons why we find change difficult in life. Changes particularly that involve loss. And again, the effect upon us is what we call grief. So this evening we're focusing really on the kind of change that comes whenever we lose someone that is close to us. But of course there are lots of causes of grief and of that kind of emotional reaction. And I'm sorry if maybe these slides aren't coming up very clearly. I'll try and keep you orientated to what we're talking about. Grief and the emotional reaction is not only caused by losing someone through death. It can be caused by losses of various kinds, for example, in relationships, separation, divorce, even infertility, where again we have that loss of the family that we had hoped for, miscarriage or abortion. Those losses can also happen, of course, in our health. We have some kind of illness that threatens our course of life. We have some kind of disability. Other losses that can cause grief are things like amputation, disfigurement through perhaps illness or injury, or even assaults upon us, things like rape and so on. Those kinds of events in our lives can give rise to that loss and that grief that we experience. It can also happen in terms of our home life. Moving house, emigration, leaving home, even something like a burglary to your home where suddenly you feel under threat and life seems to change direction. Again, that can cause a grieving reaction. And then, of course, loss of a job, redundancy, retirement. Those can cause emotional reactions that are akin to grief. Now bear in mind that in all of those areas then, we're talking about those changes of direction, giving up certain goals, giving up hopes, leaving what's comfortable and familiar, and breaking patterns of living that we have become used to. They all cause grief. But what is grief? What do we mean whenever we use that word, let me just give you a few definitions before we look more closely at it. We use the word bereavement sometimes, and bereavement really is talking about our general reaction to the loss of someone or something that meant a lot to us personally and emotionally. So it can be the loss of someone close to us, like a husband or a wife, but it can also be the loss of a pet, as we've seen, the loss of health, or the loss of our role in life. Whenever then we talk about grief, we're talking about our emotional response, how that affects us emotionally and in our feelings, and we'll look at that more closely in a moment, the feelings and experiences that we get whenever we face those changes in life. And then we have that term mourning, and mourning really refers to the way that we express our grief. So if grief is how we're feeling inside because of these changes, then mourning is how we express that outwardly. For example, in generations past, people would have worn black during that period known as mourning. It was an outward expression of how they were feeling inwardly. Let's look then a bit more at what these stages of grief are that we often hear people talking about. What does the process feel like? What is the experience of grief? And we can think of it maybe in certain stages or phases. Now, different people slice this up in different ways. Sometimes people look at 5 stages of grieving. I think it's simpler just to look at 3 stages. And really what those stages are that they are certain patterns at certain times following a loss that are there for most people. And although we're talking about these phases, it's important how we look at this, because it's not the case that you have a phase and then you neatly move into the next phase and then you neatly move into the last phase of this grieving. People don't move smoothly from one to the other. It's just really a helpful way of dividing up the various feelings and experiences that people tend to get at certain points in the whole grieving process. So let's look at this first stage here that we'll call numbness. Anyone who has suffered grief, suffered a bereavement, will know that there is that early stage where really the mind cannot take in what has happened. The mind is struggling just to take in the loss of this person, and that first reaction then can be just one of shock and disbelief that the person has now gone. And we may not actually feel anything at the beginning. We fail to take in what has happened. People sometimes will say, I was in a kind of a daze. I didn't feel anything. Nothing felt real to me. I just felt as if I was existing. And it's very tempting for us to think that this isn't healthy. And yet I must say that I think it's, again, part of God's design and part of how God has designed that we should be able to cope and get through what is a major change in our life right at the beginning. And very often we need that initial strength to get through a period where arrangements have to be made, the funeral has to be sorted out, and other practical matters have to be attended to. So this numbness phase is a phase where the mind is just struggling to get to take it all in, and yet it can help us to cope at the beginning. We sometimes call it a phase of denial. The person who has been bereaved will often acknowledge the death verbally. They may express some emotion, but it doesn't seem to really register. And that numbness can be a very, very strong experience. And for some people, they don't even seem to acknowledge that there has been a death at all. And again, it's a natural phase for us to go through. It's also seen sometimes in a refusal to allow memories in of the deceased. For example, a man who is unable to look at photographs of his deceased wife, who won't be able to visit the grave and just seems, even at a later stage, not to be able to just take it in. His mind is struggling to really take in what has happened. It's a phase that can last at the beginning for a number of days, for some people a few weeks, and even for a number of people up to a few months, or even longer. So that first phase of numbness, shock, disbelief, we struggle to take it in. That phase, though, will then give way eventually to the next phase, which we sometimes call yearning. And it's maybe helpful to think of this phase as the mind searching. The mind is searching for answers, searching for the person who has gone, and is trying now to begin to take in the reality that the dead person has gone. It can bring on at times a very intense pining after the lost, after the person who has been lost. A pining even after the old way of life that has also been lost with the deceased. So we have in that phase then also reminiscence. We go over the past memories. We go over old stories. We recall what kind of person the deceased was. And it's one of the functions of the wake and one of the helpful functions of that. It can be a source of comfort very often for those that are left behind, reminiscence. Hallucinations can be a feature of this phase where the mind begins to play tricks on you. Commonly it involves maybe seeing the deceased person. You're walking down the town and you're looking down the street, and somewhere there in the crowd you just think you've seen them, and you look twice and you look again, and you could swear that you've seen the person who has died. Maybe you've come in from work and you hear a noise in the house and you're nearly sure it's them moving about upstairs. May happen also whenever you're just dropping off to sleep or even waking out of sleep. Another common situation is where in the dimness of light, maybe in the bedroom at night, you're looking and you're nearly sure you can see the figure of the person who has died somewhere in the room. And what's really happening there is that it's all part of this search, the mind searching, trying to take in what has happened, trying to come to terms with it, trying to make sense of the loss. And so it's a common thing. It's a natural thing. It's a normal thing. It's a normal part of the process. And sometimes people can be quite alarmed whenever they have these experiences. It's important to know that you're not ill, you're not losing your mind. It's part actually of the process of grieving. Another common symptom is anger. Anger that the person has left. Anger that you're now left to pick up the pieces. Anger that it shouldn't have happened. It isn't fair. Why has this happened to us? Guilt is another very common emotion in this phase of grieving. I could have done something to prevent this, we think, or I'm to blame for what happened. And guilt and bereavement will often manifest itself in the if-onlys. If only I had done this, if only we hadn't had that argument, if only I'd phoned him at that time. I wish there had been a chance to sort such and such a thing out. And we can feel that there is unfinished business. I should have done more. I never forgive myself. I'll come back to some of those in a moment, but just to say that those feelings of guilt and self-blame are very, very common in grieving. Well, these symptoms then, anger, guilt, and even those hallucinations can give way to symptoms such as fear, anxiety, the muscles tense. We get butterflies and churning. The heart begins to pound. We sweat. We get that kind of panicky feeling. Again, it's very common in grief. Loneliness. You come back to that empty home. Desperately difficult for people, especially if the loss has been of a very significant companion, such as a husband or a wife. Hopelessness. The people may try to begin at this stage to look forward again, but remember the direction has changed and the pathway is unfamiliar, the goals look different, the destination doesn't seem to be the same, and that can all seem very threatening. It can seem as if there is no way forward without the person who has died, and very hard to envisage a future without them. And then there's that helplessness. I don't know how I'll manage. They did everything. The thought of taking on new responsibilities, which have been left by the deceased, it seems too much to be able to handle and to cope with. And as you cast your eye again down some of those features of that yearning phase of grief, you'll see that it can look quite like depression. Some of those symptoms were very familiar in the pattern that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, and sometimes indeed a grieving process can tip into depression. This phase of grief, again, depending on circumstances, which we'll look at in a few moments, can last for anywhere from about 6 months, even up to a year or two. Again, not always at the same intensity, but those kind of symptoms can linger over that period of time. So there's an initial phase, a number of weeks of numbness, and then that can give way into months, into a year or more of yearning. And then finally, the mind moves into this phase where it begins to come to terms and begins to accept what has happened. And we call this phase reorganization. Although we may feel that we never fully get over the loss of someone that has been very close to us, we will often come to a point of acceptance where the yearning begins to fade, where we begin to accept those changes that the death brings in, and we begin then to plot a new course. Remember, life has changed direction, but we begin then to see a way forward. We begin to see fresh goals in a fresh direction. And life becomes reorganized along this new track. We gain some new companions on the journey. We begin to plot a new course and take on new challenges. And actually, it can begin to bring a sense of relief. And from having felt very threatened by this change, we can then begin to feel more secure as we move along this new course. So we begin to accept there's a new direction and there are new goals to aim for. And we'll be coming in a wee moment as to how we begin to do some of these things and work them out in practice. Just before we leave, looking at these stages, let me just point out a few things to remember. Everybody is individual, and no two people will grieve in exactly the same way. And it's important to remember that even a husband and a wife who have lost someone that seemed to be equally close to them. We can often think that because someone who is close to us, who has lost this, the person who was in our family, and we can think because they're not reacting in the way that I do, that there's something wrong, that they're not grieving properly. There's something wrong with this person's grief. But we're all individual, and we'll experience these phases according to our own individual way. No two people will grieve in exactly the same way, and it's very important to remember that, because sometimes it can be the cause of difficulty and tension and misunderstanding within families. Another point to remember is that, as I said at the beginning, it's not a nice, neat tracking through each of these phases. We go through a numbness phase, and then we wake up the next day and suddenly we're into the yearning phase now. We don't move through the phases in that way, and that's one of the dangers of having this kind of framework to go by. It's rather more like an ebbing and flowing, where we start off in this numbness phase, and eventually we begin to kind of ebb and flow a little bit into the yearning, but sometimes we move back into the numbness where the mind just doesn't seem to be able to take it in. And the flow is in that general direction going through the three phases, but there's an ebbing backwards and forwards, like the tide of the sea. For example, a man who maybe even a few years after losing his wife is unable to look at photographs still of her. He's gone through many of the other phases here, and in some respects has even begun to reorganize his life, and yet there's this one point where in a sense he's still way back at that first phase of the numbness, and his mind isn't able to take things in. The time scales are not set in stone. Again, we're all individuals, and these are just helpful for us to understand some of the ways that we'll be feeling as we grieve. Another important thing to remember is that people in different cultures actually grieve differently. And I suppose as we become something more of a multicultural society here, it's important to bear that in mind. There are some cultures who still go through a very ritualized grieving, the way that we may have done more generations ago. I've said that it's a very individual thing. Let's look at why sometimes we grieve differently and how we then sometimes can develop this thing that we might call complicated grief. Grief that doesn't just move right through all of those phases. And there are certain factors that can sometimes predict whether grief will be complicated or prolonged. And I'm raising this really because there may be some of you here will think, well, yes, I can identify with some of those phases, but really I've been struggling with this for a very long time and don't seem to be moving through the phases as I would like to see. Well, there are factors that can make grief more complicated. For example, where the loss happened, where the place of death was. Someone who has been bereaved of someone who was far away from them. For example, you may have a relative who is far away, or someone from your family has emigrated and traveled far away, and they die when they're in that faraway place. And particularly if the dead body or even the grave has not been seen, it's harder then for the mind to take in and to accept and to come to terms with what has happened. How many deaths happened? We sometimes call this coincidental deaths, where there have been a number of deaths occurring together simultaneously, multiple deaths, maybe in a family or in a community. We were just talking actually before we came in there of a family in whom there had been a number of deaths in a short space of time. And sometimes that can make grief a very complicated thing, partly because the process of grieving gets interrupted by the next death happening. We see it sometimes where there have been multiple suicides. And in an area, it happened in the Mid-Ulster area near where I live a number of years back, where there was a spate of suicides amongst young people. And sometimes whenever that happens and there's that number of deaths in quick succession, it can be hard to move through all of these phases of grieving. The kind of death or the nature of the death is also relevant, where the death has been sudden or untimely or violent or traumatic. It can be more difficult to grieve, and suicide would be an example of that. And then the kind of social network that we're in and where we're experiencing our grief, where there are closely knit families and communities, that can help us through the process. But if we're more isolated, then that can hinder our process of grieving. One case I remember of a complicated, very prolonged, difficult grieving process was of a family who had lost their son to a drugs overdose in a different country, and the couple were now divorced. And you can see how in a situation like that, where the death happened somewhere far away, it was of a young man, so it was untimely. There was a certain violent aspect to it because of the overdose, and the couple were divorced, and so there wasn't that closeness and companionship to help each other through the grieving process. You can see how in that kind of example, then there are going to be difficulties in the grieving. There are other factors that can make grief more complicated. How much you loved the person. And yet sometimes we will expect that the more we love someone, the more difficult we will find the grieving. And yet even sometimes there are those that we know we loved, and that yet we don't go through all of the emotions of grief. What's more important perhaps is how significant the person was to our lives. How big a part did this person play in my life? What was my attitude towards that person? How significant was their role in my life? Whenever you think about that, it doesn't then need to be a close relative. But if this person, even though they weren't a close relative to you, if they were a significant part of your life, and if they were an intimate part of your life, then their loss is going to be greater for you. The quality of the relationship. In a sense, the more straightforward the relationship was, then the less complicated the grief. But whenever we are talking about a relationship which was more complicated, a love-hate relationship, or if that relationship was associated with a lot of guilt, then the grieving will be more complicated. And then the kind of grief where there are a lot of unanswered questions, kind of situation where there are lots of questions which we'll look at in a few moments, which have no easy answers. That can lead to a more complicated grieving process. So those are some of the things that can make grief more difficult. But how do we deal with grief? What do we do? How do we cope with the grieving process? Well, remember, the numbness stage is a stage where the mind really struggles to take in what has happened. And so it's not a time for deep discussion, not a time for trying to answer big questions which will just all go over someone's head, because really everything is numb and they're not taking things in. That early stage, that stage of numbness, is really a time for sympathy, for trying to feel and to enter into what the other person might be facing, for weeping with those who weep. It's a time for listening. Allow the story to be told. The more the story of the circumstances of the death are told, then often the easier it is for the person to begin to come to terms with it, and the more the mind will be allowed to accept the reality of what has happened. It can be very hard for us, can't it, to know exactly what to say whenever someone has lost someone important to them. So just listen. Don't be afraid of silence. Learn to tolerate silence in those kinds of situations. And just being there can be very, very important for the bereaved. Another helpful thing is to be practical. There are things to be done. There may be funeral arrangements. There may be visitors to the home. Often there's hospitality, often there's plenty of tea to be made. And whenever you've been through this experience yourself, you can think back and maybe think of what you found helpful and try to be practically helpful in the same kind of way. Be a friend. Don't disappear. Be there. Be faithful to someone who is grieving. And I suppose it's important to mention it as well. Be careful about interfering. If you're a step removed from the situation, then certainly be there, but also give them their place and give them their space and let them make their decisions, and don't get into any conflict or discussions. Conflict at times of grieving can be remembered for a very, very long time. And so it's important to avoid that at all costs. So be careful about interfering. What about then this next stage of yearning, where we have all of those various symptoms that we mentioned earlier? Well, keep listening. Listen to how the person is doing. Look for maybe some of those features that we have talked about. Try to understand where the person is at. Think of how the grief is affecting them. And whenever they're expressing some of those symptoms, then remind yourself, yes, this is them yearning. This is them pining. This is them longing for the person that they have lost. And try to understand their symptoms in that way. Reassure them. Whenever you come across someone who's in that yearning phase and expressing all of those symptoms of maybe guilt and anger and even some of those symptoms where the mind plays tricks on you, reassure them. Reassure them that it's normal to feel that way. It's okay to feel pain. There's been a loss. It's a real loss. Help them to see that life has faced a roadblock. Everything does change. There is a change of routine. It will affect them. Help them to see that the mind is searching. The mind is trying to make sense of all of this. And it'll take time for that to happen. Let them know that the mind can play tricks on them and that they're not going mad. And even that kind of reassurance can be very helpful to someone in this situation. And then try to face issues honestly. There will be questions. There will be hard questions at this stage. And whilst in that phase of numbness, it's not really the time to begin to get into those things. Perhaps as someone moves more in the months afterwards into this yearning phase, it can be helpful to begin gently and sensitively to try and address some of those questions with them. Be careful how you do it. It's not a time for lecturing. It's a time, as we've said before, of yes, speaking the truth, trying to bring God's truth into the situation, but speaking that truth carefully, gently, and in love to those that you are ministering to. I'm going to look at a few of those questions for a moment. Let me just say before I do that, although I'm going to look at them now for a moment, this is not the way that you would deal with these questions necessarily with someone who's grieving. We just want to try and face them and look at some of the issues that might come up, but they need to be dealt with very, very sensitively. It's not to say as well that these are necessarily the best answers and they may not fit for everyone, but we'll have to try and face and look at some of them briefly. It shouldn't have happened. If the bereaved feels angry and they're not able to move on from that anger seems to be a sticking point with them, then it's important to address that with them. Why are they angry? They may feel angry because there was that unfinished business with the deceased. There may have been some failure in the care of the one who has died. And it's important to face those matters honestly. Important too for us to begin to think that God does also appoint the times and the limits to our life. Remember the words of Psalm 139, your eyes, says the psalmist, saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Our days ordained by God. Acts 17, Paul says there, from one man God made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. And gently and sensitively to be reminding someone that God has his times and his limits set out can help a person to see that God had his timing. I could have done more, if only. Remember that sense of guilt. And at times, perhaps we have to face that we didn't do all that we could. We are all weak. We are all poor in spirit. There, maybe many reasons why more could have been done for the person who died. I suppose we might say that there could always have been more done. So sometimes there is guilt that is real guilt, but also that often the guilt that we feel during grief is a false guilt, a guilt for which there is no good reason, a guilt that we feel and that we then go back and try and hunt for reasons for that guilt. Where the guilt is real, where there were failures, then it drives us back to the cross always, doesn't it? Where all our failures and omissions are dealt with and paid for. But where that guilt is just a feeling, where there's no real reason for it, where it's not true guilt, then we've got to ask, well, why is it there? Perhaps we are judging ourselves by our own standards rather than God's standards. Perhaps we feel that we should have called more often with the person, we should have got the doctor sooner. And yet those around us can often look on and say to us, well, you had many other things to do, many other responsibilities. And what's happening there is very often that what we're doing in our grief is that we're setting up a standard for ourselves that we believe we have fallen short of. And the problem is not that we neglected to do those things that we felt we should have, but the problem is that we've set a standard for ourselves that God has never set for us. And we're judging ourselves harshly, and the guilt that we have is not real guilt. It's important to recognize that and to see that, and sometimes we can help a person to recognize that. That then leads us on to this one, and which of us have never said this before? I just can't forgive myself. You've heard people say that if you haven't said it yourself. I know God forgives me, but I just can't forgive myself. And what's going on in that situation? Well, again, often we're judging ourselves by our own standards rather than by God's standards. We're taking our own standard and what we believe we should have done and placing it alongside God's standard. There's a danger in which we can make almost an idol of what we feel we should have done instead of accepting that it is the Lord who has brought this along. The Lord who gave the life and the Lord who has taken it away. I know what he was really like. Sometimes in the midst of grief, there can be a conflict. After someone's death, their reputation can be portrayed as near perfect. All of the good qualities are focused on, and there's a place for that. But the weaknesses and the failures often are overlooked. And for those that are closest to the person, sometimes that can create a tension. They know that at home, well, the person wasn't always the best kind of person. They weren't always the most pleasant. They could be hard to live with at times. And it's important privately, sensitively, to acknowledge that that may have been the case and to be honest with the grieving person about that. And sometimes that can help a person to deal with a lot of stuff that's locked away in there. How will I cope? Again, when someone significant is taken from us, it can leave a very large hole. It can leave a lot of fear and uncertainty and anxiety about the future. And well, we can help someone by looking at that practically. What needs to be done? Where do the concerns lie? But also to be reminded that even when the deceased was alive and you felt you needed them so much and you felt you were depending on them, ultimately it was always the Lord who was your helper. Even though you felt you needed them so much, God was your real helper and he has never left you. One of the most difficult ones, of course, is where is he now? Where is she now? Sometimes we have confidence. Sometimes someone has made a clear profession of faith. There was evidence. We can have confidence that they're with the Lord. But sometimes we don't have that confidence. And it's very, very hard. And often, I suppose, the folk that come along in counseling who have been struggling with their grief and it's got more complicated and they need more help, they come along with this kind of very difficult question. It's a very, very hard question that needs to be dealt with ever so gently and ever so sensitively. And yet I suppose it can't be hidden from either. I do think in heaven there will be surprises. The Lord himself says that not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will be there in heaven. And I think too that there will often be surprises in the other direction. There will be many who knew that thief on the cross with Jesus and who would be shocked to think that he was in paradise or had gone to paradise and was with the Lord now. And I think that there may be many last moment calls from God and calls to God. And we must leave that with him. We leave that with him. These are questions then that come up as the mind is searching, as the mind is trying to find answers and come to terms with grief. And we need to look at these questions honestly as someone tries to resolve their loss. And if we skim over the difficult questions without facing them honestly, then we don't give ourselves or those that we're trying to help a chance to do that. Well, finally then, we look at this reorganization phase. And how do we help someone through that? Well, as the issues begin to get resolved and the yearning reduces, we find that we begin to get some good days and a bit more light coming through, and the good days get better and they increase in frequency and the bad days get less and not as bad. And yet sometimes you could be going along nicely thinking, I'm really getting through this, things are coming together, and then suddenly, bang, out of the blue, an awful day hits you. I remember I had a friend who he and his wife lost a child, and of course it took them a very long time to go through their process of grieving. And I remember him describing to me that he felt things were beginning to come together, they were beginning to see a way through, they were beginning to move forward. And he was driving to work one day, going down the motorway, and then just suddenly out of the blue, bang, it hit him again, and floods of tears. He had to pull over onto the hard shoulder and try to pull himself together. Those days can happen, and it's not unusual, and you've got to expect that. It's the overall trend that's important. So in this phase, we need to encourage the reorganization of life. We try to help the person to see that that change of direction needs to happen. God has still a purpose for their lives. He still has works for them to do. He's still completing his work in their life. There is purpose. And so there is a new direction and there are new goals. And we try to help a person to see that and to set those new goals and to establish those new routines. Part of that is looking for new opportunities. How will they spend time now when life looks so different? What was the old routine like, and what possibilities are there now for establishing a new routine? It may mean taking on new interests, new outlets, new hobbies. What is a person good at? What do they like doing? What could they try out for the first time? Is there a new hobby they could take on? Is there something they could do, a course they could do, some new learning? Importantly as well, other ways of finding new relationships, new friendships, new companionship. Very, very important for trying to combat the loneliness. And all of this working towards the setting of new goals, the plotting of that new course, setting a new purpose, and reorganizing life. Let me just very briefly look at grief in children. There is a little image there, it's not coming through very, very clearly. Children grieve slightly differently from adults. Up to the age of 5, a child may expect the dead person to return. Important to recognize that whenever you're thinking about how the loss of someone is affecting a child, and it can explain some of their reactions. Up to around 8 to 10, then a child will begin to develop an adult's concept of death. They begin in their own way to move through some of those phases that we've discussed this evening. Important to remember, though, that a child, particularly under the age of 10, can often feel that somehow they have caused the death. It's a very heartbreaking thing to hear whenever a child admits that, but they may think that they've had some kind of row with the parent and that's why the parent died. And so for all of these reasons, and because a child can have a lot of those things locked away inside, it's important to let a child talk through what's going on and see what they're thinking. And grief in a child can manifest itself in all kinds of different ways, all kinds of different fears, but it's all really a manifestation of the grief. And so trying to allow the child to talk and trying to see what's on, going on in there can help to correct maybe some of the wrong thinking. Important for a child to have memories, good memories of a parent or some significant person that they've lost. And sometimes people recommend creating things like memory books and having little boxes with photos and mementos and that kind of thing, or just writing out thoughts and good memories that they've had of the deceased, and that can very often help a child through that period. As we take that different direction in life, we've seen that it's an opportunity to look at life, to look at the direction of life, to look at our purpose, to look at our goals, to look at what I live for, to look at even those deeper issues of the heart. Why do we respond in the way that we do? Why is it that grief affects us in the way that we've described this evening? And are there any answers to that kind of ultimate loss? I want to finish by mentioning briefly a group of men who went through a very complicated grief. They were a group of young men, and they had to face the death of one of their crowd, one of their friends. It was untimely. This man was only in his early 30s, and it was a terribly unusual killing. It was a government-led killing. It was a very unjust killing. The victim was innocent. And it was in circumstances of fear. Because of the circumstances, most of the deceased's friends fled for fear that they might be implicated in the death. And the deceased had been a major part of their lives. It had been a very close group of young men. They had spent the guts of 3 years together, and it left very many unanswered questions for them. The man who had died had promised great things for them, and now it all seemed to be in tatters. They ticked a lot of those boxes for a very complicated grief. The death, of course, was Jesus, and it was his execution at the hands of Pilate and the Jewish leaders, and his friends were those disciples that felt that pain. They went into denial. They were yearning. They were searching. And yet what we read in the Bible is that very quickly this gave way to lives that were very reorganized and that were suddenly full of purpose again and full of determination and hope. And I suppose the question for us is, how come? Why did that happen? What made the difference? Well, of course, we know that what made the difference was that their friend Jesus didn't stay dead. On the third day after his execution, he came back to life. He met with the disciples. He was seen by many, many witnesses, and we have an historical record today of his appearances. And when he met with them again, he said these words to them. He said to them, "I will never leave you." Grief, as we've seen, is about loss. Not just loss through death, but losses of many different kinds. And the question for us is, where can we really find something permanent in a world and in a life that is full of loss? Where can we find that permanent relationship that can never be lost? Well, we find it in a personal relationship with this Jesus. What he is promising here then is a relationship that will never end. Everything else in life will change. Everything else in life will disappear. And yet not even death can take away this relationship that he offers to us. I will never leave you, he says. How come? How come death, the ultimate loss, cannot take away that relationship with Jesus? Well, Jesus himself lost a friend to death, a friend he loved, a friend he had visited, a friend he stayed with, a friend who was very significant to him. And when Jesus faced his friend's death, he was troubled, he was distressed, he wept. And then he did an amazing thing, and you know the story. He took his friend's dead, lifeless, decaying body, and with words he called it to life. And Jesus' friend Lazarus rose. And Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. What was Jesus saying there? He was saying, I am facing your greatest enemy, which is death, and I have won. I have won. I am the resurrection and the life. Why is grief so hard? Grief is so hard because death is an enemy. The Bible calls death an enemy. And yet at the cross, on that first Easter Sunday, when Jesus died, death was beaten. And the hope that Jesus gives us is real. And heaven is a reality. And that's why, as we read in 1 Thessalonians, we do not, as Christians, grieve like those who have no hope. Jesus will never leave us, either in our grief or in our death. Let's pray together. Our God, you have given us the only real answer to our grief and to our loss. You have offered us this relationship with the one who is the resurrection and the life. And it's our prayer that all here would know that relationship with him and that hope that nothing, not even death, can take away. We pray, Lord, that you would bless your words to each of us, and we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.